In choosing a chairman for our panel today, we turn to a young man who is an old friend of the university. We knew him as a man who both individually and as the representative of his company had given devoted service to his country. During the dark days of the war, he spent much time with the scientists who worked in the laboratories under the west stands on our campus. His task was to bring the great scientific, technical, and organizational strength of his company to bear on one of our nation's most urgent problems, the construction of a vastly complex and totally new industry, the large-scale production of plutonium. Without a background of scientific research, and particularly fundamental research, and a tradition of flexible and far-seeing management, he and his associates would never have been able to begin the job. And perhaps it would not be inappropriate to remind the government of our country at this time that without bigness, the company, as we came to call it, could never have successfully discharged the gigantic task assigned it. And at a profit, may I remind everyone, of exactly $1. Gentlemen, it is a pleasure to introduce you to the president of one of America's great industrial pioneers, the DuPont Company, Mr. Crawford H. Greenewalt.
I was hoping Chancellor Kimpton wouldn't remind me of unpleasant subjects. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it seems quite appropriate on this day, which is the 10th anniversary of the first self-sustaining chain reaction, to consider what the future holds for that new source of energy. That is a very difficult problem, because actually I don't think there is much before us that we can say that is a reality. So that I think the answer to that question will require the use of several crystal balls. Now, I notice that the gentlemen on the panel don't have their crystal balls with them. Perhaps they have them in their pocket. I might say also that I can think of no more distinguished panel to deal with this subject. And I think that if anybody can deal with it, the gentleman that you see before you can deal with it as well as anyone could. We are to discuss the industrial uses of atomic energy in the next 10 years. I agree fully with what Dr. Compton said to you a few moments ago about the current use of atomic energy. It's unfortunate that it should have to be used for the defense of the nation, but there it is, and that's something that I don't suppose we can avoid. I think, however, that the constructive thing is to look farther ahead to the time when, God willing, it will not have to be used for the defense of the nation, and that great source of energy can be turned to the advancement of the world in peace. Now, without further ado, I think I should now introduce to you your very distinguished and knowledgeable panel. I'm glad I don't have to compete with them. All I have to do is to keep them in order, which I also hope will not be necessary. We have, as representing the Atomic Energy Commission, Dr. William Davidson, who is Director of the Office of Industrial Development and is taking the place of Mr. Gordon Dean. We have also, of the Atomic Energy Commission, Dr. Donald Lockridge, Assistant Director of Reactor Development, who is taking the place of Dr. Hafstad. We have Dr. Arthur Compton, who has already distinguished himself before you, who is Chancellor, as you know, of Washington University. Dr. Enrico Fermi, the Charles Swift Distinguished Service Professor of Physics and of the Institute for Nuclear Studies. Murray Jocelyn, Assistant to the President, Commonwealth Edison, who brings to us the point of view of one of our great public utilities. Dr. Charles Allen Thomas, President of the Monsanto Chemical Company. Dr. Thomas himself and his company have contributed enormously to the development of atomic energy so far. Dr. Wallace, professor of the School of Business and chairman of the Committee on Statistics of the University of Chicago, and Dr. Walter Zinn, director of the Argonne National Laboratory of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. So you see, gentlemen, we have business, science, government, and with that combination, I'm quite confident that any problem, no matter how complex, can be well and promptly dealt with. Now, there has been a great deal of talk earlier today about reactors, or as they are sometimes called, piles. And I'm wondering if it would not add, perhaps to the understanding of you ladies and gentlemen, if we had a brief discussion of a pile or an atomic reactor, so that you would understand what it is and in simple language how it works. I would like, if I may, to ask Dr. Fermi if he would not explain that to you using the model which you will see at his left.
Here a scale model of the first atomic pile. Let me first mention to you that this white part is merely a wooden scaffolding that serves to support a good part of the rest of the structure, and the most visible thing that has a functional significance is this black material. This is graphite. It's bricks of graphite, very many of them piled up in this pile, which was a little bit over 20 feet high. So that gives you approximately the dimensions. But of course, it is not only graphite inside. There is uranium spread throughout the interior of this mass. Very many of these bricks of graphite that were approximately this long, this wide, this high, would contain holes drilled into them in which some amount of uranium or of uranium oxide was lodged. And now I will tell you briefly that this machine would start to work by itself the moment the last layer of graphite is added. If all these things here we simulate control rods were removed from it. And it would start to operate as follows. There would be some neutrons produced in the uranium that would collide against the graphite, be slowed down to the appropriate energy, react again with uranium, produce more neutrons, have them again slow down, react, and so on and so forth. At a rate that would be controlled, if the structure is too small, too many of these neutrons would fly away. But as soon as the mass becomes large enough, and this is, or actually the thing of which this is modeled, was barely large enough, there would be always a small excess so that the reaction would gather momentum as it goes and at a rather leisurely pace increase in its intensity. At the rate at which this unit was operated 10 years ago, you hardly would see anything unless you were equipped with suitable instruments. But if you had been so reckless as to let the thing go on unchecked, let's say overnight, well, or maybe for a few hours, then the rate of reaction would have been so great that this mass could conceivably have become red hot and would have killed everybody in sight by the intensity of its radiation. Now, this would have been, of course, very unpleasant for us 41 people who were about the room at that time, so we thought that it would be a good idea to control the reaction, and this is done by means of only one of these many control rods, which have essentially the following function. As you see, they can be inserted deeper inside or further out of the mass. And what they do is essentially to eat up some of the neutrons that keep the reaction going. If you want the reaction to proceed faster, you remove some of this cadmium rod. If you want it to proceed slower, you push it in, and controlling this huge mass of material is usually done by a reasonably skillful operator, or by not necessarily a very skillful operator, merely by watching an instrument that indicates the level of the reaction and moving this thing in and out as the case demands. This, I think, is perhaps the general idea that you had in mind.
It is indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, with that introduction, perhaps we can come to our knitting. I think I should also tell you that this discussion that follows is practically unrehearsed. We had a little get-together this morning, but the arguments went so hot and heavy that I was unable to get through the outline, so that perhaps some of that argument will translate itself usefully in the discussion that we're going to have now. I'd like to open the discussion by posing this question for our panel. What industrial applications for atomic energy can now be foreseen? And in asking them to answer that question, I would like for the time being to take off the 10-year limitation that has been imposed on the title, so that I would like to have the answer to that question without the 10-year time axis, so that we can see at the moment what gleams in the eye for industrial applications are before us. Now, I think that since the Atomic Energy Commission has been dealing most importantly with that question, I would like to ask Dr. Davidson if he wouldn't lead off.
Thank you, Mr. Greenwald. Before I do attempt to answer that, I would like to express the sincere regrets of Mr. Dean that he is unable to be here today. He had looked forward to attending this meeting, but as often happens, an unexpected problem arose at the last moment, and he had to bow out. Now, after the succinct address by Dr. Compton and the demonstration by Dr. Fermi, why, it's perhaps a bit anticlimactical for me to attempt to tell you what uses we might expect from nuclear energy in the future. But very briefly, we might review that by just asking ourselves, what are the products of nuclear fission? There are really three in number. First, tremendous amounts of heat. Two, extra neutrons, which can be utilized to make more fissionable material or to make radioactive isotopes. And three, great fluxes of nuclear radiation seething within the reactor, and also much radiation coming from the ashes of the fission process, namely the fission products, at some later time. So those are the three things we have to work with. Radioisotopes, which are made in the reactor in great quantities due to the absorption of neutrons, are already being used rather extensively in industrial work, both at the research, development, and process control level. We know more today about what makes alloy strong, how sulfur vulcanizes rubber, and how some of the worthwhile chemical reactions take place thanks to the use of radioisotopes. We also can use them in thickness gauges to precisely measure the thickness of layers of paper and rubber. One of these thickness gauges potentially can save a rubber or paper manufacturer literally thousands of dollars annually, even though it only contains a few dollars worth of a radioisotope. We have not yet found commercially worthwhile uses for these nuclear radiations, which are available to us in tremendous quantities. However, a couple of years ago, the Stanford Research Institute was commissioned by the Commission to look into the possible uses of these things, and they came up with a number of potentially valuable uses. These include the sterilization of high-cost materials such as antibiotics and hormones, things that can't be sterilized with heat because they break down in the process. Even the sterilization of food, if these fission products can be packaged and made available on an economic basis, perhaps used to activate low-level light sources and static eliminators, and perhaps even as low-level, low-demand power sources. So you see, potentially, there are a considerable number of industrial uses for these radiations. And the third product is the one that makes the nuclear reactor engineer's eyes glisten, namely these tremendous quantities of heat which can be obtained from the nuclear fission process. And of course, we think there in terms of power and process heat for industry, and conceivably sometime in the future for using nuclear power and propelling commercial vehicles both on the sea and in the air, as well as the military is now thinking of doing this with their military vehicles. This very briefly, I think, puts in some perspective the outlook for the products of the fission process today.
Are there any other ideas as to potential industrial applications? Dr. Thomas, do you want to put on your rose-tinted glasses?
Not just yet, Crawford.
Dr. Fermi, have you any suggestions as to where these results might be used industrially?
Not really. I think that the enumeration seemed to me quite complete. Of course, I always think in good part of the use for science, which indirectly will bear on industrial results, and there are, of course, a number of things that can be done in that line.
Dr. Compton, do you wish to add anything?
I think that I've already given some comments on the general field, which have been similar to those of Mr. Davidson, but I would emphasize likewise with Fermi the importance in the scientific field, which as one looks down the line, has great possibilities before it. I think of the use particularly of the tracer chemical, of the tracer isotopes. There's also the field in the more specifically scientific aspects in the use of the neutrons as alternates to other kinds of radiations with which one can do things. And these, although not of direct industrial importance, our experience shows us that whenever you find something that is important scientifically, before long it becomes likewise significant in the industrial way. These are things, I think, however, as you suggest, that go beyond our 10-year limit.
Well, then, I wonder if it isn't fair to summarize the answer to the question in this way, that we have already developed a number of uses for these radioactive isotopes. We have some further possible applications for the radiations that emanate from the pile or from the isotopes themselves. We have a vast number of possibilities as aids to science, let's say secondary to other investigations. And then we have, finally, the very large question of power and power generation. Now, to put these things in proper perspective, I think I'd like to come to the next question, and that is, do any members of the panel think that the uses for the isotopes, the radiations, sterilization of food, or any of the other things not connected with power generation could be sufficiently important to justify, in their own right, an atomic reactor development program. Dr. Thomas, can I get you on that one?
Why, I feel that the great use in my lifetime, or maybe my son's lifetime, or children's lifetime, and I'm particularly interested in that, really, is in power. And outside of that, I don't see that there's very much to talk about. As a scientific tool, yes. As radioisotopes as a tool, certainly I wouldn't minimize that, but from an industrial standpoint, to bring something to the world that I think is important, I think that power overshadows everything that we see in the next 10 years. That's my own personal feeling.
Perhaps in that connection, I might try to develop another point. I understand that the Atomic Energy Commission is operating at Oak Ridge, a reactor whose principal mission is the supply of these radioactive isotopes as they are used in science today. I understand also that the arrangement that the Atomic Energy Commission makes is to sell those isotopes at cost. And I suppose that that implies a rather substantial governmental subsidy in their production. Is that right, Dr. Davidson?
That is essentially right. The government only attempts to collect the out-of-pocket costs in the production of these isotopes, assuming that the reactor was already built and would be used for commission work anyhow, so it is not necessary to ask the public or the users of these isotopes to pay the overhead and the amortization costs on the reactor.
I suppose then it would be fair to say that if the Atomic Energy Commission charged full cost for the isotopes that it makes at Clinton, in other words, if it attempted to make the Clinton reactor a profitable matter, as we normally consider private enterprise profit, the price of these isotopes would be out of reach.
I think you're probably right. It is true that two commercial organizations, namely the Bendix people and the Tracer Lab people, are currently looking into this possibility. Now, they haven't rendered their final reports now, but I think you're probably safe in saying that it doesn't look that they could compete very favorably with the present prices of radioisotopes as charged by the government.
Well, then, would the panel agree with this summing up that unless there is an industrially profitable production of power, these secondary uses will be so expensive that they will have to be subsidized in one form or another?
I would put it this way, that dollar-wise, certainly power is the big product that we have to worry about or consider in the future.
Well, I think we've perhaps narrowed the topic for discussion down to the power question, which is certainly the large one. We can agree that these uses, attractive and important though they may be, from a commercial sense, will be byproduct uses and will come into their own perhaps after a power development has been successfully made. Yes, Dr. Compton.
Just one comment before we make that too firm. Mr. Davidson called attention to the fact that one of the products is neutrons, and that these neutrons can be used for producing isotopes. I would merely call attention to the fact that the most important of those isotopes commercially now is plutonium, and that has a very great importance. It has a great importance for the national safety at the present time, and one does not see clearly down the line but that it may have continuing importance. If we include the value of the plutonium, I would say that we might even reverse our idea as to where the industrial significance comes if we put a price on the plutonium. But I think that has already been discounted from the way you've approached the problem. I'm merely pointing out that it is really the value of as a source of neutrons to produce isotopes that is the prime reason for existence at the present time.
Well, I wonder if we could make that point crystal clear, Dr. Compton. I was eliminating in these questions that I've been asking the military uses of either plutonium or U-235 entirely. I was assuming that in God's good time, there will be no need for stockpiling these things as instrumentalities of war. Now, assuming that that time has come, do you still feel that the applications for plutonium for peacetime purposes are sufficiently important to make that end in itself something that's worthwhile from a commercial point of view?
If you put it for the next 10 years, I would say no. But if you put it for a period down the line farther, I would strongly suspect that plutonium might be found to be an exceedingly important article of commerce as a concentrated source of readily available energy.
But there again, it's because of its energy content and not because of any inherent chemical nature of plutonium itself that you think it would be valuable.
I would agree.
So that we, in a sense, really, we come back to the power question. Well, now, that certainly is the $64 question. There's been a great deal that's been written about atomic power. Much of it, I must say, in my view at least, perhaps I shouldn't have a view as moderator, but over-optimistic. I wonder whether, since we are now going to embark into the power question, it wouldn't be worthwhile to ask Mr. Jocelyn, as representative of one of our great public utilities, who makes his living on the production and sale of power, to tell us a little something about the present situation economically. In other words, what competition atomic energy must meet if it is to take its place as a primary source of power. Would you be prepared to discuss that for a few minutes, Mr. Jocelyn?
I might first say, Mr. Greenwalt, I'm like the sandlot baseball player who suddenly finds himself playing on the New York Yankees. My group, the group that's studying power, is a group of Commonwealth Edison and Public Service Company of Northern Illinois engineers. And at the end of our first year of study, we found, or concluded, that electricity from the nuclear power plant that we know how to build today will cost more than that produced by a conventional power station fueled with coal, oil, or gas. On the other hand, we qualified this otherwise disappointing conclusion by stating that, one, nuclear power is feasible. In fact, we submitted two feasible designs. Feasible meaning practical from an engineering, construction, and operating standpoint, but not necessarily economic. And second, we feel that at least one of the designs could be economic, and there are no doubt a number of others, if credited with the present military value of the plutonium produced. This is where we get right to the heart of the plutonium question. Or putting it another way around, a dual purpose, that is a power and plutonium reactor, can probably reduce the cost of plutonium for the military through the credit received from the power produced. Now, if these statements have any validity, you might ask, well, why isn't the problem solved? And why don't we start construction? But there are two serious drawbacks as I see it. First, no one knows how long the military market for plutonium will be sustained. And we feel that the value of plutonium as a fuel is considerably less than its value as weapons material. Nuclear power plant investment costs, incidentally, are high, and therefore this long-term market is needed to allow for reasonable amortization. Secondly, military decisions determine the expansion of plutonium production facilities. Time schedules for completion are all important. The stakes are apparently too high to accept the later completion date of a somewhat more complicated dual-purpose plant, or incur that remote risk of failure. It's obvious that There's less risk in building more of the same kind of reactors we now have, and it can be done quicker. We, therefore, are in no position to be critical of this status of nuclear power that you hear bandied around so much these days. I think there's more criticism within your group of experts in the field than from outside, and that's a valid one. That's one where the team that won the tough series has got a right to do a little Monday morning quarterbacking about how much better they might have played the game. But the thing that we are rather concerned about and want to be rather serious about is that in this next decade or 2 decades for that matter, where we go on this matter of power, nuclear power, is going to depend an awful lot on the decisions made today. And the most needed decision is to build a nuclear power plant in order to get the actual operating experience. The utility industry, with which I'm more familiar, did not spend years of research and development so that its first electric generating station might employ high-pressure, high-temperature equipment and high-capacity circuit breakers. The historic Pearl Street station of Edison was not even a Model T, it was a one-lunger. And even though we're amateurs in the field, relatively, we think we could build a Model T nuclear power plant today. And however, we're so impressed with this collective ability and ingenuity and knowledge that's accumulated in the field that we feel we're on the verge of economic nuclear power, if you please. We're on the verge, but it depends on whether or not we make a start.
Your point of view, Mr. Jocelyn, I take it as something like this, that you would regard it as entirely feasible to build a Model T, as you call it, plant that would generate electricity and at the same time would make plutonium. Your point about economics is that unless the government is willing to pay a weapons price for the plutonium that plant produces, such a development could not be economic. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I wonder what the Atomic Energy Commission has to say on that subject. Mr. Lockridge, I wonder if you'd speak.
Thank you, Mr. Greenwald. I would like to comment on that because, in general, I certainly agree with what Mr. Jocelyn has said. I would like to introduce one additional idea, however, though, that I think the American public has not quite realized in the past how much contribution military support has been in a number of our, at present, everyday types of technical items. For instance, I take the airplane. It is my belief that without the, call it heavy subsidization if you want to, or probably what many people would choose to call it, large purchases of airplanes, I do not believe that we would have the commercial aviation which you have at the present time. A large amount of the development of our modern type commercial airplane arose from research and development funds which were provided by the military.
Well, I take it that we're all agreed, at least I hope we are, on this premise that power from atomic energy entirely for itself is not economic in the light of today's knowledge. That, however, Mr. Jocelyn and Mr. Lockridge both appear to believe that, Mr. Lockridge, that the military developments, Mr. Jocelyn, that a dual-purpose plant, which makes plutonium along with power, would help the development of the power per se along by virtue of what is learned in connection with the construction of those plants. That, I take it, is the point of view with which you both would agree. Now, we've had nothing but sweetness and light so far. Is there anyone that disagrees with that point of view?
Go ahead. Well, there is one point on which I merely seek information. Power, I suppose, has a different cost in different locations. Near a coal mine, presumably power is cheap. Near a place where hydroelectric power can readily be developed, it is cheap. There are places, perhaps not so much in this country as through the world, where conditions may not be so favorable. And I wonder whether anybody has the elements to discuss this point of view. I would be personally curious to know whether the argument that power cannot compete without the price of the plutonium produced potentially as a weapon would apply geographically to all the world, or to most of the world, or to the United States, or to where?
Well, is there anyone wishes to deal with that question? Is there any knowledge on that question? Dr. Davidson, have your people given consideration to that problem?
Why, the Commission has given quite a bit of consideration to that, and in fact today has a team looking into the high-cost areas in this country. This team is a part of the Reactor Development Division, so I think Dr. Lockridge can probably tell us what the status is, if it's available for publication at the moment.
Well, it's in a study status, so that the final conclusions are not available as yet, but I can say this, that in the preliminary survey, we find that the cost of power fluctuates tremendously around the country by factors of 4, 5, 6 or more. And I think it's fair to say that at the present time, the Army is becoming greatly interested in the possibility of a type of what we might call package power reactor, which can be placed in very isolated communities where there's no hope of any other type of power, but for military reasons, they would like to have power there, and the cost, of course, would be prohibitive from the standpoint of commercial power. But from those standpoints, to try to answer Dr. Fermi's question, I think we can say that the cost of power within the continental limits of the United States varies all over the map. You can get about anything you wanted, although it's nothing in comparison to what the Army would be prepared to pay for it in such outlying places as, say, northern Alaska.
Well, then I take it, Dr. Lockridge, that the answer to Dr. Fermi's question, in your view, would be that looking at power generation from a strictly commercial and non-military point of view, you do not know of any location in this country, at least, where it would be conceivable that atomic power from atomic energy would be commercially successful.
I wouldn't want to make that categorical answer right now, no.
Well,
I think Dr. Zinn has some ideas on this.
Well, I'd like very much to hear from him.
Well, I'd just like to remark that we started out by saying that research uses and so on did not provide any considerable market for atomic power. Now, if you talk about places where power is exceedingly expensive, it can't be a very large market either. So how can you interest utility companies and so on in the problem? Utility companies in this country will necessarily be interested in large markets. This means competing with an industry which has had many years of development and has done very wonderful things in making electricity out of coal. This is the basic problem and leads to what I call the power dilemma. We know now how to make nuclear machines which will generate power at cost which is, let us say, an order of magnitude greater than what is now used or at the cost in commercial establishments. Submarine reactor is being built. This would have a cost of an order of magnitude or more. We also know how to run very large reactor plants for making plutonium. The problem is to bring these together and get the power out of a large machine at a competitive cost. And the dilemma arises because if we try to make the plant small, the cost turns out to be large. If we make the plant very large, where we have some chance of getting the cost, let us say, within a factor of two of competitive price, then the capital investment is very large, and the question is, whose money shall it be? This is the basic dilemma.
Well, I think that's a very fair statement of the problem. Well, now, I wonder then if we could get down, and now I think we're getting into the realm of sheer speculation. I wonder whether we could get down to what I'd like to call the atomic energy power problem per se. And that is problems that we face in designing and building a power plant whose prime product will be power, and which does not have to rely upon the sale or other disposition of any byproducts. Now, in opening that question, I wonder, I'd like again, I think, to call on Mr. Jocelyn and Mr. Lockridge see if we can get some numbers here that indicate how far away, in some quantitative way, we are from the goal. As I understand it, Mr. Jocelyn, it is the point of view of the utilities that the atomic energy installation would replace merely the boiler and the steam that is generated. That is, the electrical generating equipment and all of that would have to be the same, whether one generated power from atomic energy or from coal. Now, I wonder if you could give us a figure on, let's say, the cost per installed kilowatt of that part of a coal station which would be replaced by an atomic energy unit.
Yes, the present-day costs run in a little different in different parts of the country, but we could assume $170 to $200 per kW, per kilowatt, of installed generating capacity for the total plant, including the fuel handling and carrying it through to stepping up the electrical output and putting it on a transmission grid. Of that, possibly $80 to $100 would be associated with the boilers and coal handling that would be displaced by the reactor. Now, there's another factor in here which we had quite a debate about in some of our preliminaries this morning. What would be the capitalized value of the fuel? And it is quite a debatable point, but you've got to assume that you're burning something else that's just a zero fuel cost, namely the uranium, for the moment, displacing the coal. And figures will vary all over the map because of the wide range of fuel costs in different parts of the country, but we might say $100 to $200 is the capitalized value of the fuel. And add the $100, the lower figure, to the $80 of the representing the investment in the portion of the plant displaced by the reactor, you get $180, or you get a range of $180 to $300 per kW for comparison of the nuclear substitute investment. Is that what you wanted?
That's what I wanted. I'd like to know also whether anybody would quarrel with those figures substantially.
Well, only in one sense. let's not get the idea that the fuel cost for a nuclear plant will necessarily be zero. It can be far from zero. It depends on what kind of plant you build, how you run it.
We'll come to that. Well, then we can say that the goal that we're shooting for, in other words, what competition, let's say, has to offer atomic energy is something that's worth $180, let's say, per installed kilowatt. Now, Dr. Lockridge, I wonder if you could give us a figure that would represent your best present ideas of the cost of an atomic energy plant per installed kilowatt.
One figure which has been released, I believe, during the last few months is the estimated cost per kilowatt for power generated in the case of our first nuclear submarine installation. It turns out to be the order of magnitude $1,400 a kilowatt in comparison to the $180 which had just been quoted. However, I should like to point out that that's a rather unfair competition comparison due to the fact that that figure includes a lot of rather very expensive naval plumbing to stand shocks of one type or another, and seems to me not to be a fair figure to use for comparisons. Another figure which I have picked up from the Navy is that the fuel total cost, the fuel and the loading, the transportation, all the logistics involved in it, to operate a submarine runs of the order $1.50 per kilowatt. So you see, the power cost there is terrific. I think a fair comparison would be, if we want to get some figure to compare with this $180 figure per kilowatt, which Mr. Johnson has mentioned, would be probably somewhere in the order of $500 to $600 a kilowatt with our present technique.
Well,
so I think we can't compete yet.
Well, there we are now. We have a figure of $180 per kilowatt for a present modern coal installation, and we have a figure which I suppose is at best a very high spot guess, $500 to $600 for an atomic energy installation that could be made today. So that one, you can see at a glance that the gap is a rather wide one. Now, I think it is time to deal with another $64 question, and that is this assumption that the cost of the fuel in an atomic energy installation is zero. Now, I think I know what Dr. Zinn has in mind in questioning that may be so, and that, I think, brings in this question of breeding. Is that right, Wally? All right. Well, now, this question of breeder, I suppose you've seen in the newspapers, and I'm not sure that I know full well what it implies, and since Dr. Fermi did such an excellent job in explaining the pile to you, I wonder if I could prevail upon his good nature to tell you something about breeding and what it means in terms of this problem of power generation.
Uranium, as you know, contains two components, of which one is active in the normal sense, and that is the so-called uranium-235, present in the amount of about 7 parts in 1,000. The remaining 993 parts in 1,000 are the uranium-238, which is normally inactive. Now, from a long-range point of view of a power industry based on uranium, clearly it's irritating if we should take the point of view that we can use only this 0.7% of active component. Now, at least theoretically, how much practically other people in this group are much better qualified to say. But at least theoretically, this does not have to be an assumption because of the following circumstance. You know that in the Hanford reactors, plutonium is fabricated, which is a substance very similar in its general property to the active component of uranium, uranium-235. Now, this substance, plutonium, is produced by converting into it the inactive part of the uranium, the uranium-238. And by and large, in the Hanford reactors, this plutonium is fabricated at the expense of the uranium-235, the active component in uranium. Now the question arises, what is the total balance in this process? Do we produce more plutonium than we destroy uranium-235, or is it the opposite? Because in the former case, we have a possibility of keeping on and on. First, we take uranium that has this 0.7% of the active component. We use it to fabricate, shall we say, for example, 0.8% of plutonium. Then we will take this 8% and we'll fabricate perhaps 9%, and so on. We can go on in principle along this line until we have consumed effectively all of the bulk of the uranium of the 993 parts per 1,000. This is essentially the idea of breeding, and I may say that theoretically it is
almost sure that breeding is a possibility, but the fact that it's a theoretical possibility leaves me still quite open-minded as to the question whether it is also a practical possibility.
Well, then could we put it this way, that the assumption that the fuel will cost a negligible amount in an atomic energy plant is dependent upon our ability to design a reactor that will breed? Because obviously, if one can only use 7 parts per thousand of the charge material, the fuel cost can scarcely be negligible and may be very substantial. So that the assumption that the fuel will cost nothing is dependent upon the solution of the breeding problem. Now, I know that Dr. Zinn has been very much interested in solving the breeding unit, and I'd like him to speak for a moment, if he will, upon the feasibility of designing a unit that will breed, in fact.
Well, I would like to first say that it's not necessary to carry the process to the extent that was indicated by Dr. Fermi. It should be realized that if you burn up 100 atoms of uranium-235 and replace it, let us say, by 80 atoms of uranium of plutonium, and then burn those 80 atoms of plutonium and replace those by some other plutonium atoms and so on, you have extended very considerably the 0.7% of uranium-235 available. This regeneration of fuel and burning it in the reactor is the thing that gives us the possibility of getting the fuel cost low. Now, we call it breeding when it actually turns out to produce more atoms of the plutonium than atoms of uranium-235 burned. But this is just an imaginary boundary line and is not necessarily the crucial point. I believe that reactors which can do this, namely replace some of the uranium-235 by plutonium and then burn the plutonium, are practical today. And that such reactors are the ones that ought to be built as the first ones in an attempt to make economical central station power. If we don't take this line, but rather say that we'll put off attempting to get some regeneration, then we will not ultimately have much chance of competing with coal as a fuel for power plants.
Well, then,
Mr.
Dr.
Greenwald.
Yes, Charlie.
I take an exception to that. I've been waiting for this.
I was hoping we'd get a little controversy.
I have no quarrel with Wally Zinn or anybody else on breeders or any of this thing. I think it's splendid. But I do not have to call to your attention, Mr. Greenwald, this word monopoly, I assure you.
Oh, gee.
Now, some of us... some of us are fearful of monopoly in government, as we are in other places. And the paradoxical thing is that the Atomic Energy Commission is just as afraid of it and would like to break this monopoly in the future. Now, the way to stop a monopoly and the way to get started on this thing is to get moving. I think Wally Zinn's idea is, I would certainly underline it, but I think that the way to start, as my good friend Mr. Jocelyn has said, is to start out with the Model T Ford, because I think many plants will have to be built before we get to the ultimate. Therefore, I have advocated 2 years ago this dual-purpose plant. It seems to me strange to worry about the usefulness of plutonium when the Atomic Energy Commission hasn't broken ground on additional plants to produce more plutonium. And therefore, I would think that a combination plant, whereby making plutonium, selling it to the government at a price no more than it's costing the government, using the same bookkeeping methods in both processes, over a period of 5 to 7 years, wouldn't be a sound way to get started to make power economically, which we feel we can do at present times, carrying a dual-purpose plant. Now, as Dr. Zinn points out quite correctly, this is largely a plutonium plant. So what? We certainly need plutonium, or you wouldn't be building more additional plutonium plants today. But by making this combination in the interim period, in the next 10 years, to get started, to throw this thing open to industry, we feel, is important. I think the fact that there's disagreement between Dr. Zinn and myself is a great compliment to the fact that he believes in competition. If anybody wished to have a plant producing one, going one way, and we wish to have a plant going the other way, we think it's in practice with the American industry to let them go their respective ways and not have a governing body set up who is going to appoint additional committees to study this plan and that plan and then pass judgment on which one is correct. Let's throw it open, and if we fall on our face, let us fall on our face. And if Dr. Zinn falls on his face, let him fall on his face. But just get this thing open to competition.
Well, there we are, gentlemen, completely unrehearsed. I take it, however, Dr. Thomas, that you would still feel that this so-called dual-purpose plant is no more than a step, but in your view, a very necessary step, on the way to what I have called an atomic power plant per se.
That is correct, but I think it's an essential step because time to get started on this thing, and I think that probably after we've got this plant built, that we'd have something that was obsolete. Now, Dr. Greenwald and I both know that in the chemical industry, this is usually the case. We build plants that are practically not finished before they're obsolete, and that is something that we have to contend with. Now, Dr. Zinn, what are you going to say?
Well, just this. I have seen two plants in their design and construction phase whose purpose it is to make plutonium. And I think I know a great deal about how they were designed and how they are to be operated. I have also seen an experimental plant which makes electricity in its design stage and operation, and I have had a close connection with a plant which will operate a submarine. So I know something about a plant which will make power. I'm getting a little impatient, however, in looking at plants which always make something else. They make plutonium or they make military power, but they are not directed towards making civilian power and making it economically. I am fearful that as long as we keep our eyes on making something else, the thing we really want won't come about. And there is a real danger here because the things that are something else have a very high price. And this very high price does not encourage in the designers and the builders and the operators the greatest care in getting the capital cost down, the capital cost of the plant. And it's this high capital cost which leads to the $500 or $600 figure that Dr. Lockridge mentioned. I have, of course, every hope that competition would do this. But we need to have, therefore, more than one such plant under construction, and not a guaranteed price of plutonium from the government, but a competitive price for plutonium or the military use in order to get the cost down. The guaranteed price from the government can hardly be called competition because you are competing with plants which were built under entirely different arrangements, not to get the cost of the power down.
Dr. Zinn, if this is unrehearsed, let it be unrehearsed. There is a counterproposal which I think you endorse where the government subsidized power. That is this packaged power plant. And in looking, and Dr. Fermi spoke of places where the small power plant would be possible, and you fell right back into the argument the military would need it. Now, in this dual-purpose plant, unless the plutonium could stand on its own feet competitive with what the government could make plutonium for, it would not have my endorsement. Now, there's such a thing as amortization. And the thing that I'm speaking of is that if the high capital cost of a nuclear reactor at a dual-purpose plant selling plutonium competitive at the present cost of the government, it gives you an opportunity over 5 years to write that capital off. And then you have an entirely different picture. And then you have your capital cost reduced, because any of us who have fooled with this, and I'm not doubting your great knowledge in it, I assure you, realize that the capital costs are the big cost items in the cost of power of atomic power plants.
But isn't the difficulty that perhaps the only plutonium plant the government really has now under your basis of 5 years is already amortized? It's rather tough to compete with it.
I don't think so, because you're building some more at Savannah River. Dr. Lothridge can tell us more of that if he can. I don't know. It may be classified. It's the power plants, not that you have at Washington, that were built in war times that we're speaking of. We're talking about the plutonium plants which are not in production yet, which are now under construction.
Well, gentlemen,
I was going to ask Dr. Zim what he would think of having the government simply call for competitive bids to supply plutonium.
I don't think you'd get any bids.
That's where I differ with you.
But doesn't that view, whether it's correct or not, bring out one of the difficulties of having any real competition here? And this is a point on which I think there's a real difference between atomic energy subsidy through purchasing plutonium and the subsidy of the aircraft industry and the diesel engine industry that Mr. Lockridge referred to. In those cases, the airplane industry, the government has subsidized it most indirectly. What they have done is not tell people how to build airplanes and to monopolize all the technical knowledge under security wraps as to how to build airplanes. Instead, they have largely subsidized it simply by contracting for airmail service. They didn't even tell the airlines what kinds of airplanes they had to buy. In this business, that seems to be not practical because of the security problem, and I wonder whether, as long as this security situation is what it has to be, there's any real hope for competition. The essential social advantage of competition comes through the possibility of free entry of anyone, fly-by-night operators, people that the government doesn't have to investigate either for loyalty or for financial soundness. That's the check that we have on big firms, and it seems to me it's completely out of the picture, as far as I make it out, in the atomic energy business within the visible future.
Well, let's see where we are now.
I didn't quite understand that, Dr. Wallace. What's completely out of the picture for...
To release the technical knowledge that would be necessary for independent operators to decide on their own whether they would like to go into this business and whether it could be done better than it's being done now, whether there are resources available that could be devoted to the industry that are not being devoted now, and in general to fall on their faces freely, as you put it.
I believe that I really believe that Dr. Warren Johnson, if he were up here, could speak to that, but he's on this committee of declassification, and I think that with the commission's help, and they've been very helpful in this, that you're going to find more declassification, not of a military nature, but of nuclear reactors, or at least I'm hopeful they will be in the future.
But on this declassification point, I wonder, and I might say I doubt, that they have economists, for example, considering declassification problems. They probably have chemists, physicists, and military experts. But one of the big issues involved would be what would be the economic gains, what would be the effect on the general social organization of our productive structure of releasing this to free competition, letting the knowledge become available. What would be the gains there as against the obvious losses from releasing the information? If you take the airplane as an example, I think offhand, if the Wright brothers had just built their airplane, everybody would say the government's got to get that completely under wraps. It's a menacing weapon, as it is. But I wonder whether the United States would have the preeminent position in aircraft production that it has if we had handled it the way we're handling atomic energy, whether the risk that we took in letting the knowledge become available to other countries. Indeed, we even sold the first of some of the important models of airplanes to foreign countries. I wonder whether those gains don't tend to be overlooked in the declassification procedures.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, Mr. Greenwald, that Mr. Wallace has made. I would like to ask the question, though, of the industries who have been involved in this in the last year or so, whether the fact that, although the commission, of course, has not opened up perfectly freely to anybody to get in and read all the information which is available on this field, as far as these particular selected 10 companies are concerned, that has been the case. So it seems to me this problem, security, is overworked in many cases, because security my impression is, did not interfere with your people's operations at all. Isn't that true, Mr.
Thomas? I agree with you fully.
Well, I'm worried about the companies that aren't in the picture now, those that are unknown companies, the way the big aircraft companies were 40 years ago.
Well, I imagine that there must have been people worried about that when Fulton first had his steamboat, but there you are. The Atomic Energy Commission has been very fine in inviting these groups in, and I think you have 10 now in. Because they didn't come in, I don't think that you could say you want to force them in. But there are 10 companies who've had this information available, which our company's one.
Well, I think that probably that is enough for that phase of it, because I gather really that there's no essential conflict between the points of view that have been expressed as to ultimate goal. I take that everybody agrees that we are not yet able to build a competitive power plant per se. And the argument that has taken place so eloquently by these various proponents relates to the method of reaching that goal. All right, now, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to close by asking a real crystal ball question. I think we have developed today that there is still a substantial distance to be gone before we can have an economic, competitive atomic energy power generating unit. You have heard considerable discussion about various methods of arriving at that goal. Now, I'd like the panel really to look into their crystal balls and say when that goal will be reached, whether it'll be 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, or never. Well, let's go around the table. Dr. Lockridge.
Oh, I'll cast 15 years.
15 years before we have an economic unit. Dr. Davidson.
I've always noted in this asking this question and hearing it kicked around that the optimists are those people who have never built a reactor. I have never built a reactor, and so I will say that within 10 years, I think we will be able to demonstrate that power can be made competitive from nuclear fuel.
Well, Professor Wallace?
I have absolutely no technical competence in the field, so before the meeting, I looked up the history on similar predictions on other inventions that have been made in the past, and my prediction is that none of the predictions made here or elsewhere will bear any relation at all to what happened.
I think that's probably the wisest answer of all. Dr. Fairley.
Well, subject to full agreement with Mr. Wallace's conclusions, my impression is that 20 years may be a reasonable figure.
Arthur? Dr. Compton?
I already gave earlier some crystal ball gazing, and I think I would stay by it. I would be surprised if we do not have some actual commercial applications of atomic power within 10 years. Now, those will be in the more expensive power areas, in large-scale production of power on an economic basis. My guess would be closer to 50 years.
Dr. Zinn?
Depends a great deal on when you set up your mind to do it. You haven't heard here today anything about the infeasibility of doing it. You haven't had any hint that we need some new technical approach in order to make it possible. Therefore, what is needed is a decision and determination to give it a whirl. And I believe that it may take 3 or 4 or 5 years to make up our minds to build a large-scale plant specifically for making power. When we do this, after another 3 or 4 years for construction, we'll have it.
Well, that adds up to 10 years, approximately. Mr. Joslin.
Again, the sand lotter. It can be, I believe, within 10 years, talking economic power again, but is not likely to be at the rate it's moving.
Dr. Thomas?
I find myself in just complete agreement with Dr. Zinn, what he just said. And I'd rather not comment on this question because I think it's completely irrelevant. I think this question has been posed at every panel that we've ever had on this subject, and I think it's completely ought to be outlawed. What's important is to first get the law changed. You cannot have any commercial power with the existing atomic, law as it now exists, in my opinion. Now, it doesn't have to be changed radically, but there has to be some changes in detail on the law. And I think I agree so fully with Dr. Zinn and with Dr. Wallace that the important thing is to get moving and get started and not worry about when we're going to do it, because that is the question that I think is so burning before the American public and the world today. So I have no comment to predict when it will be. I'm only urging that we get started.
Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, you have all the answers.
Well, just want to say, as you asked your last question, I couldn't help thinking that we probably have never had, in these forecasts, such a fine collection of prophets gathered together since the days of the Old Testament, or so many variations and possibilities since people estimated on the time of the Second Coming. But it's my duty and pleasure, Mr. Greenwald, to thank you on behalf of the Association and, of course, of the University as well for taking care of this panel so competently, and to thank all of you who have participated for being here and doing the very interesting and competent job which you've done this afternoon for this audience. So again, on behalf of the University and the Association, and again expressing my pleasure for the Association that we have been permitted to join with the University in celebrating this occasion, this meeting is adjourned.